From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A memorial service was held in Lebanon for an American journalist killed in a car accident in Turkey near the Syrian border. Press TV correspondent Serena Shim was killed when her car was rammed by a cement truck Sunday. She and her camera person were returning from the scene of a report in the city of Suruç covering developments in Kobani. The Turkish government has still not released the details of the incident, including the identity of the truck driver, as of press time Tuesday. The late American journalist covered reports for Press TV in Lebanon, Iraq, Turkey, and Ukraine, some of which were carried here. She was married and had two children. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe and Mariam Soledad, former colleagues, spoke about the late reporter.
From the beginning, she was always so outgoing, ready for anything, and nothing could stop her. She was always dreaming of going to places which are much more encouraging, of course, even places that are challenging. And she had always hoped that she would have a sort of legacy, of course, as a journalist. It wasn't enough for her just to sit at the office, do normal analysis, perhaps, and political news. She wanted more than that, and she found that outside of Beirut, especially when she went to areas like Iraq, Ukraine, and then finally she went to Kobani. She knew that she would always be in danger. She knew that she was in danger, putting herself in line. She was right in front, right in the middle of these conflicts. But that's something that was very fulfilling for her. And that was clear from the words that she had said, from how she was always dedicated. And over here, she always wanted to go ahead with issues, even if they were challenging. That was even more encouraging for her to go ahead with a story. Of course, when you speak to her family, they still cannot believe. They are in a state of disbelief. But of course, what they are looking for is perhaps a little more information, something to somewhat let them ease this anger inside of them, or this pain that they're feeling, this sorrow. They want to have more. They want to see more cooperation from the Turkish government. They want to know more detail about what happened, so that they can be somewhat at ease. Of course, her sister and her mother are in Turkey right now, preparing for the transfer of her body back to Lebanon. And she had asked to be, of course, buried in Lebanon, although she is an American citizen. The entire Press TV family, all our correspondents, and we understand as journalists that we are always in danger, perhaps, wherever we go. But however, the price of telling the truth is not always easy, and we always have to, of course, we remember Maya Nasser in Syria, other journalists from other mediums, of course, and this is something that perhaps will happen to anyone, any one of us, at any time of conflict, especially.
I'd like to find out, because I haven't gotten the details yet. I'm not too sure if there's an autopsy that's been done. I'm not too sure if the hospital has released the information as to what caused her the death. I mean, what caused her to actually pass away. Do we have any of those details at this point yet?
Well, there's always contradictions. It's not that clear if the person who was driving is actually the camera woman, and perhaps I think even her a relative at the same time. Whether the driving was the circumstances of the driving, the weather at that time, it was too dark. Whether that was the case, or whether it was something planned, it's not really clear, because the other person who survived the accident is yet to speak out, because I think she is in an intensive care right now in the hospital. But what we know is that the Turkish government needs to cooperate more. We need to get an autopsy. We need to understand really what happened in order for her family to feel at ease. Now her family family believes that it's not a real car accident. They believe she was threatened, and she had told them that she felt that she was threatened. But what the truth is exactly, this is what the families want, and this is what they need to know. Whether it was an accident or more cooperation. The identity of the driver needs to be known. His details, his witness. So this is why the family is in a state of disbelief, and they want answers to their questions. And of course, like I said, some of her family members are in Turkey right now, trying to get those answers. And once we can get anything, of course, we'll let you know firsthand.
A person living in Africa over the 7 months of the Ebola outbreak was 40 times as likely to die from basic hunger and 70 times as likely to die from malaria, both easily avoidable conditions, as they were to die from Ebola. Here in the U.S., there have thus far been only a pair of cases of the disease identified, but the response stands in dark contrast to the indifference of authorities to the many thousands of deaths caused by hunger and a number of preventable diseases. Here in the U.S., 120 people are being monitored in Texas alone for Ebola. Schools have been closed in Ohio, and other extraordinary measures are being taken elsewhere. But is it fear or science that's driving the mad dash to establish public policy to deal with Ebola? RT's Guyan Chichikayan reports.
Ebola has infected only a handful of Americans, but the fear of Ebola has now captured millions. Some of the measures that people take seem to go beyond simple caution. A teacher at an elementary school in the state of Maine was ordered into isolation because she happened to have stayed at a hotel 10 miles or 16 kilometers from the hospital in Texas where the first American was diagnosed with Ebola. The teacher was one of 5 million people who commute through the city in Texas. A college in Texas has refused to accept students from West Africa. In Mississippi, hundreds of parents pulled their children out of a middle school after learning that its principal had traveled to Zambia, a country untouched by Ebola and located 3,000 miles from Ebola-hit nations. Syracuse University has canceled an event with the Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer who left Africa 3 weeks ago, although the photographer showed no symptoms of the virus. And 3 weeks is the incubation period for Ebola. Abundance of caution is a phrase that officials and administrators use very often these days. Out of such abundance of caution, a woman was reportedly locked inside an airplane's bathroom after she vomited on a flight from Dallas. Another woman vomited near the Pentagon, and the authorities kept her and 22 people on the bus that she had taken earlier quarantined for hours before they learned that nobody had Ebola. Hospitals in the U.S. are bracing themselves for Ebola panic ahead of the flu season. You know, some Ebola symptoms mirror flu. On average, 200,000 people in the U.S. get hospitalized for flu every year. Flu, by the way, which people fear less than Ebola, has killed a lot more people. Annual flu deaths in the U.S. have ranged from 3,000 people to 49,000. Doctors say at this point you're far more likely to die from not receiving a flu shot than from Ebola. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Chakyan, RT.
In Hong Kong, officials and protesters sat down for the first time to talk. The discussion was carried on TV. We have this report from the Chinese news agency, CCTV.
The Hong Kong SAR government is now holding talks with the student protesters participating in the Occupy Central movement. The meeting is being held at the Hong Kong Academy of Medicine. It's the first time the two sides have exchanged views face-to-face and discussed Hong Kong's constitutional reforms. Let's have a listen to what they're saying.
The police resorted to force to resolve a political issue. No, it's not going to happen. And since the situation has changed in Hong Kong, the government has the constitutional duty to perform. The MPCSC laid out the framework on the 31st of August, but now the current public sentiment is that abolishing the functional constituencies is a matter of urgency, and then there should be equal nominating rights.
The most recent barrage of attacks by Ukrainian government forces and right-wing militias on the city of Donetsk added 4 more civilians to the local body count. We have this from Press TV.
At least four civilians have been killed as fighting continues between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces in the country's east. Much of the fighting has been focused on the government-held airport in the city of Donetsk. The clashes come despite a ceasefire that's been in place since early September. The airport is the last stronghold of government forces in a city controlled by pro-Russian militiamen. The fighting in East Ukraine began a month after the residents of the Crimean Peninsula chose to rejoin Russia following a referendum in March. According to the UN, over 3,600 people have been killed in the East Ukraine violence.
Ukraine's foreign ministry Tuesday called on Russia to prevent independent elections of regional leaders and legislative bodies in the self-proclaimed Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics that are currently set for November 2nd. Ukrainian foreign ministry spokesperson Yevhen Perebinus said at a press briefing that Russia would be held responsible for the peace process breakdown in the event the elections are held. Those elections would compete with local elections run by Kiev, which are scheduled to take place on December 7th, under the law on special status of parts of the Donetsk and Luhansk regions, which took effect last week. The Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko, said Kiev could change the date of those elections if necessary. However, the leaders of the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics have laid claim to the whole territory within the borders of their respective administrative entities in Ukraine and want full independence. Both self-proclaimed republics have set elections of regional leaders and legislative bodies for the earlier date of November 2nd. No word yet on the fate of the 43 missing students in Guadiana, Mexico, whose whereabouts have been unknown since they were attacked by local police in Iguala September 26th. Dawn Paley, a research student in Mexico and a correspondent for progressive webzines, described the circumstances surrounding the disappearance of the students with CPR's Warwick Fry in Mexico City last Thursday.
Basically, the story is that on September 26th, there was a massacre. There was basically police attacked a number of buses, including buses carrying students, and killed six people on the evening of Friday, September 26th. They then proceeded to detain initially, it was actually 57 people. 14 of them were later released, and 43 of them remain missing or are disappeared after having been detained by police on September 26th.
Meanwhile, the case has drawn the attention of some of the relevant international organizations. Jesus Peña Palacios, deputy representative of the Office of the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, told members of Mexico's Congress there were enough elements to determine that, although the case of the missing students rose to the legal threshold of consideration as a forced disappearance, the Mexican government was too slow to act. He said within the first 72 hours after the armed police attack, the state should have applied protocols that would trigger an official search for the students, but they failed to do so. The municipal police of Iguala, who were under the command of its now fugitive mayor, José Luis Abarca, have been considered as culpable since the students disappeared. The Mexican army has also been implicated, as the students apparently went to the headquarters of the local battalion number 27 to ask for help when the police attacked, but the army reportedly refused to intervene to protect them. Fernando Velazquez is the executive producer of Informativa Pacifica, a daily Spanish-language newscast produced at Pacifica station KPFK in Los Angeles. We spoke with him about the case and the political context of the investigation Tuesday.
Okay, well, there's three layers to this. One is the public relations launched by the President Peña Nieto's camp that is trying to give the impression to the world, more than anything else to the world, partly to the people of Mexico, that the Peña Nieto's administration is doing something about it. Some police officers have been arrested. There is an investigation. That's that. So the president is doing everything he's supposed to be doing. And then there's the second layer, which is in the war on drugs / Merida initiative. paid by the United States Congress and coordinated to a large degree by several U.S. government agencies, CIA, DEA, Homeland Security, to name a few, to allegedly put a stop to the drug cartels, drug trafficking coming from South Central and South America into the United States. And the end result of that initiative, the Merida Initiative, is the implementation of Plan Colombia with a different name in Mexico with this identical results, massive displacement, disappearances, assassination, rampant organized crime and cartels and groups and organizations with an apparent no control. And while this is happening, government agencies from the United States, from the DEA to the FBI to others, allegedly collaborating with the Sinaloa cartel in supposedly in an exchange for information, whereas the Sinaloa cartel is going to help the United States government and the Mexican government find all the other competitors, and by using the Chapo Guzman organization to track down and arrest and all the other criminals, and then put an end to that alleged problem. The end result of that initiative translates into more bloodshed, more disappearances, more assassination, more displacement, and the drug flow, like the U.S. war on drugs, it never stops. Right. Then is the third layer, which is the people's response, which is something that it takes it projects itself as self-defense militias in different parts of Mexico. The most prominent ones, the Michoacan self-defense organization, some of which have joined the Mexican government, the others who refuse to do so. Their leader, Dr. Mireles, is in prison, and just a few days ago he was sent to prison. His sentence was offering was given, despite the fact that his attorney, Talia Vasquez, saying that every part of the Mexican law was violated, no fair trial, no independent analysis, no independent investigations, no legal counsel and representation according to the law. So a sham trial at best. The guy is in prison, and that's only part of the resistance. The other part of the resistance, it can be seen in the Mexican university and college students, in the workers, and now with the Zapatistas. On November 20th, which is the anniversary of the Mexican Revolution, there's a general strike being called. So that's the other layer. Now, there's another element that is important at this point. Carlos Facio, a very, very prominent investigator and analyst who has the recognition and the authority to speak because of the thorough investigative work that he has done through the years in matters of geopolitics, in matters of drug trafficking and guerrilla organizations and so forth. His take is that this scandal, the 43 students, what's happening in the state of Guerrero, benefits first and foremost the United States, because it weakens more, even more, the President Peña Nieto administration, which means more concessions to Washington, in the same way that his predecessor, Felipe Calderón, gave more and more concessions to Washington, because he came as a spurio, as a president who was illegitimate, not recognized by anybody, and the only way he could possibly gain some recognition and then legitimacy was to launch the so-called war on drugs with the results that we know. In the process, more and more concessions were given. The most prominent, the most visible ones, the CIA, DEA, FBI, Homeland Security, working in Mexico like they operate in their own country, in their own home. Concession, Mexican independence and sovereignty flushed down the drain, among other things. This is what Carlos Fax is saying. It remains to be seen between now and November 20th what's going to be the response, what's going to happen. In the meantime, more and more underground mass graves have been found. The priest Alejandro Solalinde from Oaxaca saying that people are afraid to say it in public, but they know that the Mexican government already know where the 43 students are, that they're dead, that they were burned, some of them perhaps even alive, but they're not going to reveal that information until after the elections, so that in the meantime they can discredit the Party of the Democratic Revolution and benefit the party of the president, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, Revolutionary Party, the PRI. So that's more or less, in a nutshell, what's happened.
So I'd like to go a little bit into, if you have time, to the politics on the ground in Mexico, which most people in this country are completely ignorant of. Not the retail politics necessarily, but the political configurations. But before that, do you think that the Mexican federal government has any complicity with the kind of local police, if the local police were in fact the ones behind the murder of these students, and it appears that that's the case, do you think that there's active complicity on the part of the Federalistas?
Well, from Father Alejandro Solalinde to many others who monitor closely what's happening with the Central American refugees, persecuted, assassinated, kidnapped, blackmailed, raped, or disappeared along the way, to other incidents in which Mexicans are disappearing, there is reason to believe that this is collaboration, no different than the Carlos Castaño self-defense paramilitary units with the Colombian military. Mm-hmm. Some point to the General Naranjo, a very prominent military man from Colombia who came to Mexico as an advisor to President Peña Nieto, and the resemblance is there. Many people are saying that this is collaboration. Hard evidence of that. I don't know what how far people are willing to go in order to prove it. Witnesses are, you know, if they open their mouths, they're probably going to be killed. On the other hand, Carlos Facio is saying that there's reason to believe the Los Zetas, the main competitor of the Sinaloa cartel, came out of, trained by the United States in Mexico and in the United States, advised by the United States, and operate from the northeastern Mexico border with the U.S., from the Texas border to the north, all the way down to the Guatemalan border in the south, where happens to be most of the oil and gas reserves. Mm-hmm. That's a territory controlled by the Zetas. Carlos Facio says they, an extension of the ruling party. There's reason to believe that that is so, and that they just want to secure that national wealth of Mexico is in that party's control. Grounds for further research, food for thought, but in terms of what happens in the ground in other organizations, in Guerrero itself, there's reason to believe that there are 8 armed organizations. There are others in the states of Oaxaca and elsewhere in Mexico. The current situation is very dangerous, is very concerning to many people, because it almost appears that the level of impunity, it used to be that the Mexican police tried to pretend that there was a difference, that there was a space, that there was a distance between them and some of the drug cartels, the paramilitary units. What's happening in Guerrero has changed all of that, because as soon as they were arrested, they were handed down to a paramilitary group and disappeared. And everyone in Mexico who's following the story is beginning to realize that this is a new phase, this is a new dimension of the so-called war on drugs, and the new expression of the current government. Other more cynical elements of the Mexican society say, hey, no surprise here, when President Peña Nieto was governor of the state of Mexico, he did something identical in the Atenco case, where they sent the federal police to break people's houses into people's houses and arrest people, rape women, dozens of women, and so forth. Interestingly enough, just in the last couple of days, after 8 years or so, the Mexican government announced that there are more people going to be arrested regarding the Atenco case, which occurred when Peña Nieto was the governor of the state of Mexico. So, food for thought.
Last question. You made reference to the oil in that territory on the eastern side. Is that the same oil that they've been negotiating and acting to privatize over the past few months?
Well, that's a done deal. As a matter of fact, every single one of these so-called reforms has been approved, approved the National Action Party and the Revolutionary Institutional Party, the PRI and the PAN, the two most prominent political parties of Mexico. They already agreed that that is so. So now it's just a matter of time where they begin to implement. There's a word out on the street that not only the normal school, the teacher schools in Guerrero, where these 43 students were operating, where they studied, there is since the 1920s to now there's been schools for the very, very poor population of the countryside, for the rural sector, for the peasants. And these schools happen to be immersed on the ground, working hand in glove with the rural sector, with the peasants. They are considered by the ruling party and their associates as a cradle for leftists. This happens to be one of the few centers of free thought in Mexico that are not being privatized, that they're really projecting a serious organized resistance to those reforms, including the energy oil privatization, and that one of the reasons why they're hitting the schools in Guerrero so hard is because they're afraid that once these reforms start, once they start implementing these reforms, these students in all the different schools associated with what is called the teacher schools, the normal escuelas normales, that these the leadership of the grassroots movements, the opposition, the main thrust of the opposition to these reforms will come exactly from those schools. That's why they want to shut them down.
I lied. This is one last question. Among both the nascent resistance to privatization and the existing say left-wing resistance, are there armed groups that could compete with the armed groups that are on the ground that sound like they're from the mostly from the right or from the government?
When you say armed groups, you're talking about the militias working for with the Mexican military and police.
I'm talking about people's armed people's groups that could stand in opposition to that.
There's three layers of those armed groups on the people's side. One of them is the Zapatista National Liberation, who apparently hasn't given up their weapons. They call themselves an independent political organization, but they haven't given up on laid down their arms, so to speak.
Right.
And then they call the EPR, the Popular Revolutionary Army, which happens to be calling like a traditional Marxist-Leninist organization, calling for the seizure of power by the use of force. Those are the most visible organizations, and hard to say, probably much bigger than the other smaller organizations. That's one. The other one is the indigenous peoples under the Mexico Constitution. Indigenous peoples have the right to have their own police and to carry arms. That's the second group. And the third is like the Dr. Mireles organization, the self-defense militias in the state of Michoacán, who happen to also exist in other parts of Mexico, who visibly they announced and identify themselves as self-defense groups.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.